You are listening to an ADIS Journal podcast.
Welcome to this podcast, where we'll be delving into an often underappreciated but vital aspect of prostate cancer care, the role of comorbidities in treatment decision making. And today I'm delighted to have two friends and experts in the field, Dr. Kirsty Balachandran and Mr. Peter Whelan. Kirsty, Peter, would you like to introduce yourself? Kirsty first, maybe?
Yes, hi there. I'm Dr. Kirsty Balachandran. I'm a medical oncologist that specialises in prostate cancer, and I also have a specialist interest and some experience in the emerging field of geriatric oncology, looking after older adults who are receiving treatment for cancer.
Thank you, Kirsty. And Peter?
Hi, my name's Peter Whelan. I'm a retired urological surgeon from St. James's in Leeds. I've had a great interest in prostate cancer for many years. I chaired the RTC prostate cancer group and also the MRC one when it was in existence. And I have continued to both do some work and to follow the great changes that have occurred over the last 40 years or so.
Wonderful. Thank you both for being here today. And I'm Kenrick Ng. I'm a consultant medical oncologist in Barts Health, and I treat prostate cancer, particularly in the advanced setting. So, just a bit of an introduction. Prostate cancer, whether a patient is dealing with localized disease or advanced prostate cancer, the overall health, including chronic conditions like cardiovascular disease, respiratory problems, or mental health issues, can significantly influence both the treatments we offer and the outcomes we expect. And while prostate cancer itself may progress slowly in many men, it's frequently the presence of competing health risks that shapes the patient's prognosis and quality of life. So, in this podcast, what I hope we'll do is to start by looking at the evidence in localized prostate cancer, where patients typically live longer, and so comorbidities really matter when deciding how aggressively to treat the patient. We'll then move on to the metastatic setting. And once considered universally life-limiting, metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer, or MHSPC, has seen remarkable progress in recent years. With better survival, there is renewed focus on how other health issues should guide our decisions around treatment intensification. And this is where Kirsty's geriatric assessment tools can come really helpful, offering structured ways to evaluate frailty, functional status, cognition, and life expectancy beyond just age or performance status. And by incorporating tools like the G8 screening tool or the comprehensive geriatric assessment, we can better personalize treatment decisions to align with each patient's overall health and goals of care. So really two sections to today's podcast. First, in the localized setting, we'll then move on to the metastatic setting, discussing different options of treatment intensification, treatment strategies, and we'll also cover broadly the idea of geriatric assessment tools. So naturally, let's start with the localized setting, starting with some of the major studies that have shaped our understanding of treatment of localized cancer, especially developments in recent years. Now, Peter, you mentioned that you have been following the developments in this field. You're obviously a heavily experienced urologist practicing for many decades now. What do you think have been the highlights in recent years in managing localized or locally advanced prostate cancer?
If I may, can I just take you back 100 years or more? The first radical prostatectomy was by Hugh Hamilton Young in the early part of the 20th century. And it never caught on, principally because although all surgeons like to take out lumps and kill people, that left patients completely impotent, and in most cases, incontinent. The change that really occurred was in 1979 when Pat Walsh, along with Dunker, his Dutch colleague, described the anatomic radical prostatectomy, which reduced incontinence rates to well under 50%, and even impotence rates were preserved in 30 or 40% of patients. Allied with this was a concept at that time that a small tumour would inevitably, if left, become an aggressive and then eventually metastatic tumour. So that a great many radical prostatectomies were done in the 80s and the 90s because of this concept, mostly patients with not at all aggressive disease. And this went against our practice at the time. Many patients who had a TURP were found to have some cancer and were actually told that they had a touch of cancer, but not to worry, and we'd check them each year if there was any things that were changing. The PROTEC study, which is the one I've been involved in, and St. James's was one of the contributors to that, was to try and put the record straight, because this massacre of the prostates that seemed to be occurring in North America did not seem correct either scientifically or even in good medical care of patients. And you can see that this under the guidance of Freddie Hamley, who's a professor in Oxford, recruited over 1,600 patients. And in essence, the three arms of the study, which were surgery, radiotherapy, and watchful waiting, or active surveillance, if you'd like to more focusing, it in essence showed, as we got out towards 20 years, there was no difference in survival. And that reinforced the prejudice of many people. And the American PIVOT study that just compared surgery against active surveillance was similar in outcome. And as a surgeon, you must understand that I take out a bladder or a kidney, partial pinectomy, orchidectomy, and I expect to cure patients in at least 50, if not greater percentage of times. And it's very hard not to go for an operation. But the evidence has always been that this is not the thing to do.
Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Peter, for putting things into context and how things have evolved across the past few decades. I guess, can I just ask, mainly for my own education, how have these two studies shaped the way we think about prostatectomies or radical treatment? And if you were practicing today, how would you do things differently?
The major difference was that there was a great aversion to treating patients with high-risk disease. So patients with Gleason 8, 9, 10 in the 80s and 90s did not have radical prostatectomies. And the difference that has happened now is people have gone for what you would have thought was logical, in that the most aggressive disease was the one that you would try and deal with aggressively yourself, whether it was with radiotherapy or by using surgery. So that is the major change that I've seen. And people have, because of the side effects and the fact that a great many patients have comorbidities, which we'll discuss later on, it seemed to be logical, but it was very difficult to actually get this logic across to the generality of urologists, who, if you can remember, until the Tannett's study of 2004 with Taxol, was an exclusively urological disease, as there was no input from medical oncologists and only a minor input from radiotherapists, who felt that their radiotherapy volume into the prostate was suboptimal, to say the least.
I think you're right, and it's quite a potent reminder, isn't it, that medical oncology and prostate cancer has only been there for the past 10 to 15 years. I remember when I started, I was told by somebody that in the 2010s, or early 2010s, there you could count the number of medical oncologists in the country, and really, things have changed. So thank you very much for sharing your insight there, Peter. Really appreciate it. I just wanted to ask you to share your thoughts about a slightly different treatment landscape. And this is the landscape in which, we have delivered radical treatment, but there was rising PSA after initial treatment. What do you think about this area of biochemical recurrence, especially in the context of next-generation imaging with PSMA PETs, etc., coming about?
Well, I think I find this very interesting, and I hope we'll be able to elucidate where the direction of travel should be. When I was with the RRTC prostate group, we actually had a consensus meeting, and it was almost chicken on a railway line as to how high a PSA level you could live with before you felt you needed to treat it, at that time virtually always with hormones. And the Europeans came up with a value of 20 based on URTC data that showed only PSAs over 40 seemed to inevitably lead to metastases. But with the same data, the swab group, very respected group in the States, came up with a value of 15. So I think anything that actually puts some science or logic into it would be very helpful.
Wonderful. Thank you very much. I wonder if there have been any new studies with PSMA PETs about looking at thresholds like this, or are we saying that this group of patients is an increasingly small entity? Are we saying that if the PSA was rising rapidly, it's more about kinetics or absolute values? Do you think that the field has changed at all on the basis of imaging and interpretation of PSA kinetics?
I do. I think two things. One is that the nadir that the PSA reaches after primary treatment is extremely helpful. It's from surgical perspectives. I mean, you often think that if you're doing high-risk patients, then the PSA is not a decimal point, then there's probably a disease there already which you haven't been able to sort out with your imaging. And I think the rate of change, especially, as again, we'll come into, depending on how fit the patient is, how young the patient is, and what their comorbidities are, you can, with these very general, and as I say, flip of a coin parameters, actually try and eke out a route for each individual patient, because you can always fall back on some form of therapy. But I think the kinetics are helpful, but obviously what everybody would like is something immensely better than the PSA.
No, I think you're absolutely right, Peter. It would be good to have. I mean, the PSA has been an extremely useful marker for prostate cancer, but you know, I think we need to start looking at other dimensions as well, ctDNA, amongst other biomarkers and whatnot. But I think this kind of brings in the theme as well. You know, we look at patients with rising PSAs post-radical treatment, and bringing us back to this theme of comorbidities, the question is, do we react to a number? Do we react to kinetics? Do we react to imaging? And when and where do we take comorbidities into account and competing comorbidities which might impact on survival? So I think it's all very interesting. And thank you again for sharing your insights. I'm just going to take this opportunity to move on to the metastatic space for a bit, where we've seen a real shift in treatment in recent years. And as you alluded to, Peter, medical oncology wasn't really a thing in prostate cancer until about 10, 15 years ago. There were very limited numbers of medical oncologists. And we can see that historically, metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer had a relatively grim outlook. Median survival, of course, depending on volume of disease and response to treatment, was typically between 2 to 3 years. But with the advent of newer systemic therapies as treatment intensification, we are now seeing median overall survival, granted in clinical trials, exceeding 5 or even 6 years. And that's quite a game changer. But with this greater overall survival comes also greater complexity. Deciding whether to escalate treatment at offset or waiting to sequence treatment requires a very nuanced approach. And I'm glad that I've got my colleague Kirsty Balachandran with me today to discuss some of these nuances. Now, Kirsty, we have obviously, you and I have trained in an era where we've seen a lot of development in treatment of prostate cancer. But I just wanted to start this section by talking about androgen deprivation therapy, or what I prefer to call testosterone suppression, you know, the degarelixes, the leuprolins. Do you think it has space in an era where the standard of care is generally treatment intensification? And do you think there's a role still of intermittent ADT in our patient population with metastatic cancer?
Thanks, Kenrick. Yes, I think we still see a role for testosterone suppression. I mean, as we've heard, it's been the mainstay of treatment for you know, a remarkable time. And clearly it is effective at controlling prostate cancer. However, it comes with its own toxicities, and I think sometimes we underestimate the potential effect of these in terms of cardiac, metabolic, mood changes that can be associated with it, and you know, really quite debilitating and distressing symptoms such as fatigue and loss of libido. And I think for some of our patients, it's a good balance in terms of response, you know, response in terms of disease response, but also in terms of the side effect profile. One area that has been quite helpful is offering patients intermittent testosterone suppression, which offers the patient breaks in which to improve their quality of life and have periods of time without those side effects. Although it hasn't been proven non-inferior to continuous therapy in terms of survival, it can be a sensible and pragmatic choice for some people. But I think that's a really careful discussion to be had with a patient in terms of ascertaining their goals and their priorities in terms of quality of life and maintaining independence.
Thanks very much, Kirsty. And on that note, it's interesting how intermittent testosterone suppression is no longer really talked about in an era where treatment intensification appears to dominate the news. But there's certainly, I hope to share my opinion, a population who are perhaps a bit more comorbid, more competing comorbidities, where actually they will die with the prostate cancer rather than off the prostate cancer. And although we don't have a non-inferiority study showing that intermittent ADT is non-inferior to continuous ADT, if the patient is appropriately consented to treatment, I think it's still a reasonable option, don't you?
I agree. I think there are some patients who anything more than ADT monotherapy is not appropriate given competing other medical conditions. And I think there's another cohort of patients who actually would decline other treatments because of the increase in side effect profile. So yes, I think there is a group for whom ADT monotherapy still has a place.
If I may, it's just that we set off in competition with the SWOG, the first intermittent study with what were then the new injectable hormones. You remember this would have progressed from orchidectomy, where intermittent therapy was sadly not an option. And we found, and this is anecdotally, the data is published in RTCs and SWOG studies, and as you quite rightly say, it wasn't able to show equivalence. But we found very few patients went off. And to emphasize Kirsty's point, patients do suffer from side effects from ADT, and often the relatives are quite distressed at the change of personality that the man undergoes, and the men themselves distressed at the tiredness that they have and the sorts of jobs they were happy to do. They find it now quite overwhelming. So I think there is a role, but again, it's selecting the patients that would best benefit from this. And of course, you can always chop and change. They may do well for 2 or 3 years, and then you have to come back onto continual therapy or additional therapy.
Peter, thank you very much for your comments. And I think you're absolutely right. You're part of many of these very key studies which drive our decision making today as well. So thank you. Kirsty, I was going to move on briefly to talk about treatment intensification. The purpose of today's podcast is not to talk about, you know, androgen receptor pathway inhibitors versus triplets and choosing between these. But as you are an expert in the field of oncogeriatrics, we've spoken a lot about choosing population not to intensify treatment and perhaps watching and waiting. What about, you know, using quite intensive treatment like triplet treatment, docetaxel, darolutamide, ADT, for the elderly population, an underrepresented population in clinical trials? But I found myself saying, you know, biologically, if you're actually quite well, why shouldn't you benefit from triplet therapy? What are your thoughts about that area of things? Should we treatment intensify patients above the age of 80 to 85, although the Arisons trial really only had 1 in 6 patients above the age of 75?
I think that's a really good point. First of all, obviously, that these patients are hugely underrepresented in clinical trials. And therefore, if we're trying to use an evidence base, we are heavily extrapolating from the data that we do have available. I think the first thing I would always point out is that chronological age, I think, is a very poor marker of a patient's fitness and appropriateness for treatment intensification. I think we really need to move away from that. And, you know, as a junior trainee, I remember sitting in MDTs where the age was counted as a significant factor. But actually, what I think we need to be moving towards is, how do we assess a patient's biological age? And there's a whole host of factors that will come into play here. So, of course, when we see a patient, we're considering their tumour biology. As oncologists, we always look at, you know, ECOG or Karnofsky performance status. But I think we need to be moving deeper from just looking at a list of comorbidities to actually doing a more formal frailty assessment to really ascertain and try and stratify which patients are likely to benefit for treatment intensification and which patients actually, you know, it's likely to do more harm than good overall. I think one of the things with this is, again, being very clear with the patients what they're hoping to get out of treatment, and being very clear in terms of their future goals. I think there is some suspicion amongst oncologists, perhaps, that geriatric oncology is all about stopping patients accessing treatment. But I think the opposite is true. This is all about sensible stratification and then optimization of patients for whom, you know, these treatment options are potential. So I think it's absolutely not about closing treatment lines down for patients. I think the other thing to point out is that we know, for example, we know that from studies like the Friedman study, that a significant number of patients don't go on to receive second line treatment after an initial AR pathway inhibitor failure. For a variety of reasons that may include side effects or deteriorating health or performance status. So I think giving your best treatments up front, if possible and safe, it is definitely something to consider up front.
Thank you very much, Kirsty. Just one final question from me, if that's okay, regarding your area of expertise. Now, hands up, I'm not particularly familiar with oncogeriatric assessment tools, but I know that there's been a drive to, as you indicated, to start utilizing these more formal structured frameworks in assessing our patients. In answering questions, not so much can we treat, but should we treat? And if so, how can we optimize the patient? So as an oncologist in clinic, if I was to see a patient with a few comorbidities above the age of, say, 75, 80, how can I best utilize these tools practically to aid my decision making?
Good question. I think there are a number of screening tools that are now available and are widely used. In the UK, I think the most commonly used is the Rockwood Clinical Frailty Scale, which is a really simple pictorial scale that we use from 1 to 8 in oncology. So it's very easy to pick out, you know, where a patient sits on that frailty scale. Another tool that's used is the G8 screening tool, which is much more commonly used in France and has a kind of stronger emphasis on nutrition. In real terms, I don't think it really matters which screening tool is used. I think it is the one that is going to be done is the best one. So if there's one that's on, you know, your trust electronic patient record, then absolutely use that one because it will be standardized across the trust. I think the other thing to say is, frailty screening should be done, you know, at the point of referral and the point of seeing a patient. But this is a dynamic process. So it's something that in an ideal world will continue, you know, at every point of either progression or disease response, at every change in treatment, because it's not something that will be static and your treatment decisions will be guided by changes in it. There are a number of services across the UK now that have fully fledged geriatric oncology services, some which have geriatrician input and some which are purely therapist led. And I think the gold standard for geriatric oncology is undertaking what we'd call comprehensive geriatric assessment, or CGA, which is this multidimensional multidisciplinary process of screening a patient, assessing them, coming up with interventions and recommendations, and then feeding through. Now, in an ideal world, this is done in a joint clinic with an oncologist, potentially a geriatrician, and then therapy input, so physiotherapist, occupational therapist, perhaps a dietitian, and a pharmacist. But I think we're all aware that at the moment, resources are not always plentiful, and sometimes that's not possible for a lot of services. So then I think, coming back to your question, Kenrick, in terms of as an oncologist, how can we approach this in clinic? I think it's going back to basics and thinking about components of frailty that can really make a big impact. So for example, in the GAP70 study, they found that 20% of patients in the control arm, so those who had no comprehensive geriatric assessment, had a fall within the first 3 months of starting SACT. Now, I find that number staggering. And actually going back to that first consultation and remembering to ask a patient, have you had a fall in the last year, I think can be a really valuable piece of information and then shifts your recommendations going forwards. So I think there are a few things like that that every oncologist could have very quickly in their head, like, have you had a fall in the last year? Having a really good look at drugs, to look at polypharmacy, for example, many of our patients are on a number of antihypertensives, but actually years down the line, their blood pressure's in their boots, which again puts them at a higher risk of falls. And again, cognition, we talked about it with ADT, but again, something that would be very quickly screened for with a mini cog in 3 minutes flat.
Jessie, thank you so much for sharing that with me. I mean, I know we work together, and this is one of the first opportunities I've had to really listen to all the amazing work you do with setting up services for oncogeriatrics and really thinking about structured assessment for our patient population. So I found that incredibly insightful, and I hope our listeners do as well. So thank you for sharing your expertise. Peter, I wonder if I could ask you one more question before I close our podcast. I mean, you know, you have had a wealth of experience of treating prostate cancer patients across the entire spectrum and have witnessed the evolution and growth of clinical oncologists being involved and now medical oncologists. Would you say that, well, I think survival has improved objectively. Do you think the service and the progress is moving in the correct direction, not just in terms of survival, but also quality of life? And do you think that multidimensional care is generally a positive thing? So are things getting a bit too complicated now?
Well, I came into the era of MDTs, but before which we'd only had a radiologist telling us what the films showed and a pathologist telling us it was cancer. And the MDT really did broaden out things. And we were lucky to have an oncology department run by Peter Selby, professor of oncology here in Leeds. And he came, or one of his colleagues came. And so we, even when they hadn't much to offer, other than often steroids, their input was extremely helpful. So I think that having a multidisciplinary group, my concern has always been, is how do you organise or get everybody together? There seems to be, that's my prejudice, I'm afraid, to show my age, but quite a lot of doctors around these days, compared with perhaps 25 or 30 years ago. But whether they can all function and with colleagues, as Kirsty was saying, from dietitians, physios, even occupational health individuals, therapists, they would be extremely useful. So I think it is going in the right way. And I think somehow or other, there needs to be a borderline where there are patients that will have primary therapy and hopefully are cured, but need a follow-up of some description. The one grey area is in the middle where it seems to be failing, but not very quickly. And then the area where some sort of treatment is necessary, otherwise the disease will run away with them. And I'm not certain that we're there yet, I'm afraid.
Peter, thank you very much again for your comments and for sharing your experience. Thank you both, really. So just to quickly wrap up, I think What we've done in this podcast is we've looked through the advancements in prostate cancer treatment, different perceptions of existing treatments in the localized and locally advanced prostate cancer. We've reviewed briefly about treatment intensification and ADT monotherapy in the metastatic setting. But importantly, the overall theme is one of considering holistic care for the patient, not just being too oncocentric at times, looking at survival, but also focusing on patient comorbidities, mental health, physical, psychological, and social health as well, alongside the cancer. And, you know, Kirsty particularly has shared how we can use structured frameworks, assessment tools, and apply them in a practical sense in clinic to best benefit our patients. So I just want to say thank you again, Dr. Kirsty Balachandran and Mr. Peter Whelan, for joining me today, and to the journal for the opportunity to share our thoughts. Have a good evening all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can listen to more podcasts by subscribing to ADIS Journal Podcasts with your preferred podcast provider, or by visiting the journal website. For a full list of declarations, including funding and author disclosure statements and copyright information, please visit the article page on the journal website. The link to the article page can be found in the podcast description.